Hi, folks. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Big Book Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and my sobriety date is Groundhog Day, 1957. Really delighted to be here. Thank you very much. I'll join that for sure. I still can't believe it. My God, a guy like me stays over this long. Something wrong. Got to be a warp in this program somewhere. I'm delighted to be back in Tampa. Good to be with you, and I really appreciate being at this conference. And surely I really want to thank you for picking Bob to pick me up at the airport. It's nice when you don't have a rookie that doesn't know anything about airports. He put in a full career in living in airports for the most part. Probably familiar with every airport in the world, just about. And I swear to God, he got me lost inside the airport. I hate to think what it'd been if it hadn't been a real pro that was coming out there. And we had a good time. We got acquainted going from red to blue. We even invented a new concourse out there, I think, called Brown or something. It really is neat to be. I appreciate the work you guys have put into this, and I appreciate the genuine warmth and consideration that's been shown. And every one of the speakers has mentioned this, and I surely want to be one as well. I not only appreciate the hospitality and consideration, but the real touch of class. Yeah, that is a real touch. I noticed in the island there as we were coming in. I didn't say anything about it, but I noticed the symbol stuck right out there in the island so that nobody but us, if we were especially alert, would even know what that meant. And I looked in here, and I had some trouble figuring out the one here. I looked at it again a few minutes ago. That one had me thrown for a bit. I didn't know what it meant about going back to basics unless we're going to start riding horses again. And it became clear as we went along. And Mildred gave me an inkling of it Friday night. That girl ought not drink no more whiskey, I'll tell you that. She's my dear, dear friend. We always have a ball when we're together. She gave me a little hint, and then God knows turned David loose this morning. And then it got progressively more violent as we went because Gracie followed him. And I know what's coming up. There's only one speaker on the speaker meetings that I hadn't heard. And I tell you, folks, when I'm the high bottom drunk in the crowd, including the Al-Anon, y'all better take a look at Mike and his program chair in here, that's for sure. Now I know what the wild horse is about. My God, there's no more appropriate symbol for this gathering that I could imagine. I really do appreciate being here. I appreciate the touch of class. I really appreciated that, I don't know if you call it needlepoint or embroidery, but I noticed during the countdown that I believe, if I didn't miss it, that the fourth oldest member here in sobriety is also the author of those very, very sensitive, thoughtful gifts. Isn't that something, though? I wonder if there's any connection between that production and that length of sobriety. I suspect there is. I want to join you in a hand for Dottie. I think that was great. That's absolutely super. And I'll always be grateful. There's some things that... I'll be very honest with you. One thing that I really don't treasure is plaques. God knows I must have 200 or 300 of those things, and I can't figure out what to do with them. Yeah, I got them in a big box, and I treasure every one of them, so I ain't going to throw them away, but what do you do with it? I know what I'm going to do with that sampler. I'm going to hang that sucker in a prize place in my house and value it every day of my life. Yeah, that is really a fine thing. It's great to be back, and I just want to share with you one other story. I like the way that program was done. You know, I didn't bring it down with me, but if you hadn't noticed it, read what it says in there, the little blurb about why we meet like this, and it's really a thoughtful kind of description about what it is that we do. You know, here we just gather up, just a whole bunch of folks. Charlie and Red and me are the only rednecks in the whole crowd. This looks like the New York, New Jersey convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. No question. My God, I wouldn't know where I was if I just got off of a train and found myself here. There ain't many Southern folks here. I've been looking for them all weekend, and it's a rare breed, brother, rare breed. If you're in here, let me know. I see one waving. My God, more. Where y'all been? I've been talking to Yankees the whole weekend here, guys. Come out of the woodwork. Be aggressive. Act like ourselves. it really is neat. I just want to share one other guy's experience. And in the spirit of what's in that, you know, what we do is just sort of bunch up. And though we are people who normally wouldn't mix, we come together in a loving kind of way. And we just sort of share with each other about what's on our hearts and what's on our minds. We're a strange-looking group when we get together, and these things often don't make any sense. We just gaggle up. We used to smoke like a locomotive in here. We don't smoke much anymore, and that hurts me because I'm from North Carolina, and tobacco's what keeps us alive, folks. I wish you'd rethink that quitting movement then. Now, I'm not smoking, but that's different. I've got a reason for it. We used to just smoke like locomotives all the time. That's what we did. And in case you're new here, I know Stormy's new, and Stormy, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope one day you'll do what I do, and that's look back to the day I walked into this program and say without any hesitation, it's the most important day of my life. And I hope very much that that'll be your experience. So we do welcome you here. It is hard to figure out what we do because, you know, if you look at, as we mingle around here, what we do is just sort of, we come in the door talking. And everybody here is talking a blue mile a minute. There ain't nobody listening. And if you lay out in the hall, as all we're doing is fat mouthing and hugging and smooching and rubbing up against, introducing ourselves over and over again, and it lasts for at least a good 10 seconds. And then we say, well, I never was good at remembering names. And we just go like that nonstop. Here we're going to do it 4 days. And we'll leave here with laryngitis for sure. But every once in a while, and what this is about, Stormy, every once in a while, we just clear the halls and bunch up in here, and one of us from somewhere, anywhere, talks. And there's no real earth-shaking value to this. It's just to give you a break. So you can sort of catch your wind and go back and talk some more. That's what speakers are for in Alcoholics. We don't ever say anything important. We just sort of fill the blank. And that's what I want to do tonight. I want to share with you a story that I have trouble believing myself. I told it in a penitentiary up in Saskatchewan one time, Mildred. And a guy, there's a couple of real slick-looking kids that came up after the meeting, and you could spot them a mile away. One of them said, man, that's some story. I said, yeah, sure is. And he said, it's really kind of hard to believe. And I said, you know, that's the darn truth, man. I sometimes wake up and say it ain't real. And he said, what I'm really trying to say is I don't believe it. I said, boy, there's hope for you. You might get a drunk. And it is a phenomenal thing. I'm a guy that got into this program. I used to think in a unique kind of way. Not anymore. Yeah, I'm just basically a garden variety guy. I got started like every other alcoholic I've ever seen in my life. And I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. I'm here because I'm somebody who found a desire to stop drinking, and this program's worked for me marvelously since the day I walked in here, and I've never gone back out, and I'm deeply, deeply grateful for that. There's obviously a story in that. That doesn't just happen, and that's what I want to share. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. It doesn't really make too much difference why. I'm just somebody who I think was an absolute setup for alcoholism the moment I started to drink. It's hot as a bull in here, isn't it? Bob said it was all right. My God. This is a very tight Christian Dior shirt. I bought it when I was skinny and never wore it. And I swear to God, I can't breathe hardly. That sucker, it hadn't grown and I hadn't shrunk. So I want to impress y'all with a Christian Dior shirt. That sucker cost $13, I think. Well, I think that was a setup. And I'm not going into a whole bunch of detail about it, but I ain't going to slip over it either because I like drunk-a-logs. I tell you, I'm a great fan of drunk-a-logs. I love that. I love talking about drinking whiskey, puking, and all that kind of stuff. Love it. Especially love mine. I could listen to it all night long. But I'm going to sacrifice tonight and not do it. And I'm not a causation freak, but I want to share with you just a little bit, I think, about where I think this thing came from in terms of the setup that was fundamental in my alcoholism and also very, very important in my recovery. Two basic things. One was in the spiritual thing. Mildred described it like our book does, as a lack of power being our dilemma. I was somebody who early in life got highly confused and aggravated about matters spiritual, about religious. I was introduced to Bible Belt religion down here in the Deep South. And while it takes with many people and many people flourish on it, it didn't take on me. And I wound up as somebody who got bitterly turned off with the whole notion of religion. And as a child, I started to realize that there was a good deal of that I simply didn't believe. And what I set up was a sort of a quiet war with that whole business of the spiritual that lasted my entire life, where I carried as a child the knowledge that I dared to disbelieve something as fearsome in my mind as God. And I never in my life shared anything seriously about that till I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Rather, what I carried around was a kind of a battle with myself, a feeling and believing one way on the inside, acting another way on the outside. And that's a setup for trouble if I've ever seen one. You know, what it produced in me was that lack of spiritual life, that lack of a center of being that gave me that empty, hollow feeling, that fearful kind of existence, that hole in the soul, that sense of emptiness. I never thought about that till I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. But that was fundamental to my alcoholism, and I think was a seedbed from which it sprang. The other thing that I think was really significant was that my folks broke up. And my relationship with my dad was a monumentally important thing in my alcoholism, but I didn't know that for a long, long time. All I knew was that my folks broke up. My dad left and deserted the family when I was 4 years old. I never saw the fella but twice in my life when I was growing up, both times frustrating, disappointing experiences. And where there should have been a father, a male role model, somebody that was important in my life, there was again an empty hole. And I had absolutely no earthly idea about the importance of that until well later in my life, long after I was in recovery, and in fact had a son of my own, where I started to realize how truly valuable a father is to his children, and especially to males, how truly important. And I never knew that. Yeah, you don't miss what you don't have, and I just simply never had that. And what I had instead was something missing in my life that was critically important in development. My mother remarried shortly after this fellow left. And she married several nice folks not at once. I mean, they were in succession. None of them took. The first one she married was a little old cretin of a man by the name of Alvin, absolutely the most obscene, vulgar man. I don't mean his language. I mean, he was just a slug of a man. And I swear to God, I hated that dude the day he drove up. He used to pick me up by my ears like Lyndon Johnson did his beagle dog. That's why they looked like this. You know? I used to have cute little ears. That fool got hold of me. And I was a little guy. And I knew that thing wasn't my daddy, but I had to call the thing daddy. And I burned every time I did it. I promised myself if I ever got big enough, I was going to whoop him like a dog. And then I came back from the Army. I was too big. It had been like whipping one of David's midget playmates. I never did get to whip the old fool. He died. And I tell you the truth, I don't even like him dead. I really don't. He buried in Oconee County, South Carolina. I go by there once in a while just to make sure he hadn't scratched out. You know? I really don't like it. Yeah, and so I grew up, and you know, he went through one loop of causation for me, but but not really the serious thing. I just grew up in a kind of a distorted sort of way, and where there should have been a male that was influencing my life, there wasn't. And I didn't understand so much until I got sober in AA what a male does, particularly to a boy. And that's the thing of breeding a sense of intimacy and trust. And I never had a problem-solving, solution-oriented discussion with a man in my life until I was sober in AA. And I, you know, if you'd asked me about that early on in my, any time in my drinking or early on in my recovery, I would have told you no big deal. We come back to it later. What that set up in me was what I hear every alcoholic I ever hear tell their story, and most Al-Anons. That sense of feeling separated from people, isolated from people, locked into self, unable to reach out and join in and integrate with other people. Always that feeling of feeling different, separated, better than, worse than, forever. Hear it with everybody, and that's exactly what I experienced. And so I was, when I went through life, I had a few little dabbling experiences with booze. And my first serious drinking in my teenage years, something happened for me that was monumentally important. First time I ever meaningfully took a drink. And what happened to me was that the magic happened. Like so many of us talk about, the magic happened. And the minute I took that drink and it hit and it had its magical influence, my life changed and it's never been the same. Now, I wasn't an alcoholic. I was just a miserable, troubled kind of kid that was kind of goofy looking. I was about 6 feet tall, weighed about 140 pounds. My ears looked like they were half of that. I was not a handsome beast, and I felt worse than I looked. And when I took that booze, man, I'm telling you, it happened. And I had that sense of confidence and peace and well-being and poise and savoir faire and all that stuff. And my God, that stuff worked. And I fell in love with it. I wasn't an alcoholic. I was just a troubled young fella who found a magical solution to the problem and absolutely loved it. Loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved the style. I loved where people drank, loved how they drank, loved the people who drank. I loved that sense of excitement, that sense of anxiety, that sense of expectation that something getting ready to jump off, and if it ain't here, it's surely going to be the next place. And if it didn't nothing happen, just start something. Yeah, those, I loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved those old rock'em, sock'em joints that we had down south. Loved those cool blues jazz joints up north. Loved that style, loved that lifestyle. And that's what happened to me. I just got caught up in it. I found a tremendous kind of euphoric release, and I would have been stupid not to drink. So that's who I was. I was just basically, the logic was there that, well, certainly more means better, and that's what happened. I just got caught up. And the fact of the business is that from the time that thing started till the time I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I really never looked back. Never really looked back. Wasn't an alcoholic. I think I became one fairly quickly, but I was not an alcoholic. I was just basically a heavy kind of drinker who got into a lot of trouble with booze. That happened, that changed when I was about 18 years old, the best I can tell. I didn't know it then, but when I look back, you know, that's when I recognized that changes came. And the only thing that yeah, I would have been drinking like that forever, except that I just happened to be one for whom alcoholism was in the picture. And looking back, well, it looks to me like along in the 18th year is where the changes came that I understand to be alcoholism. Now, you can go into a whole bunch of stuff about that. Yeah, I really like the way our book defines alcoholism in many ways. Some of it was read today in a meeting where we did Chapter 3. And when you look at the language of Chapter 3, there's a lot of very vivid descriptive language in there where it describes in real gory terms what the nature of this disease is about. Let me tell you the definition that I like the very best. It's contained in one simple sentence with just a half dozen words or so, where it says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And I like that definition. Now, that's not a Wild West definition. I like that definition. It's not gory. If you want a gory one, read a paragraph above. If you want some real blood and guts, read one right after. I like this one. I like those two, but I like this one because it's the crux of the issue. We alcoholics, men and women, have lost the ability to control our drinking, and that's exactly what happened to me in my 18th year. Didn't know it, had no earthly idea. And I dare say any observer would have seen no discernible difference one day from the next. But what happened was it was almost as if overnight, I know it wasn't, but it was almost as if overnight, my way of relating to my drinking changed. I didn't know it. I just became aware of the fact that I started to feel different. Before I became alcoholic, I took a sort of perverse pride in how much I drank. I was proud of the fact I was always the last guy to leave his joint, the last one on his feet, drove the others home, always the one that never wanted to end the party. I was proud of that. And almost as if overnight, that completely reversed. Where before I would have bragged about how much I drank, all at once I started to minimize. I started to lie the other way. I started to hold down. I started to seek out people who drank like me and found fewer and fewer. I started to drink alone. And I would submit to you that social drinking, by definition, demands the presence of other people. If there ain't other people, it ain't social. And I started to do that. I started to experience the normal retinue of problems that are associated with folks who lose the ability to control. Let me tell you why I like that definition so well. I like it because we really are a mixed bag. I like it because it's a clear and forthright statement. It's not caught up in melodrama. It's not caught up in who drank the most. As a matter of fact, that definition has nothing to do with how much I drank. It has nothing to do with how long I drank, how old I am. It has nothing to do with whether I am homosexual, heterosexual, bisexual, any sexual. Has nothing to do with that. Has nothing to do with whether I'm black or white or yellow or from Brazil or wherever. Nothing to do with that. It has nothing to do with whether I'm rich or poor, redneck or Yankee. Has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with how much trouble I got into. How much trouble I have got into has nothing to do with alcoholism by that definition. And it's not the core of the issue. The core of the issue is that I was one who lost the ability to control his drinking. And I developed alcoholism. I didn't develop drunkenness. I didn't develop irresponsibility. I developed alcoholism. And when I developed alcoholism, I parted company with every other drinker in the world except other alcoholics. In the sense that what I had is an incurable illness and will have till the day I die. And it's an illness characterized by an inability to control my drinking. And the thing that happened to me that day and exists to this day is that if I take one drink of anything with alcohol in it, I cannot predict my behavior. I simply don't know. Yeah, I think there are three basic. I just want to talk just a few minutes about this. Three basic things that our book describes vividly when it talks about alcoholism. The book describes this as essentially a spiritual dilemma. That lack of power, that emptiness in the soul. I think the seedbed, the very foundation of my alcoholism right there. The other way it describes, one of the other ways it describes the illness is as a mental disease, a mental illness. And a mental illness characterized by some strange kinds of things. One is a preoccupation with drinking that just sort of stays on my mind. Now, I've been sober a long, long time. Not by Charlie's standards since May the 15th to 45. Not that long. But I still do not have just a reasonable, normal person reaction to alcohol. Now, I'm not against it particularly. In fact, if anything, I'm a little bit too much for it. You know, if I see people drinking, I encourage them to drink. I want them to drink a bunch. You know, they used to get me to bartend at my company Christmas party. Till they found out that people were dancing on their knees, you know, and they couldn't figure out what happened, so they looked to the bar. Well, I figured, you know, they got me to 10 bar because I was the only sober guy there. And I figured if somebody asked me for a drink, they meant it. And so, I give them a drink. And man, them poor old deacons were having a ball there more than they wanted to. They don't let me tend bar anymore. But, you know, I don't mind that. I sort of look at that as my personal membership recruiting program. I don't know anybody any other way that folks get here. You know, so it's that sort of thing, you know, just sort of a way of thinking about that alcohol never will be quite the same thing as me. I'm not fanatic about it. It's just that I recognize that way. I sort of got a goofy way of thinking about it. That's one level. That's one level. That's not what that's not what we're talking about in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think, when we talk about the mental illness. The thing that's troubling, like some of the other folks have said, is that our problem is not in the physical element of alcoholism. The problem is not in the body, it's in the mind. And the thing that is absolutely bedeviling about this thing is a thing called obsession. It's a thing called obsession that periodically seems to occur in the minds of alcoholics, where an overwhelming urge to drink comes on that's so powerful that no human power is able to resist. None. Now, I don't understand that, but I can tell you from personal experience that it happens, and that it happens in recovery, and that it happens to people who are actively working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the book can be, it's kind of like reading the Bible out of context. You know, you can read what you want. You know, and you have to be careful, I think, when you're looking at the book and how it deals with it, because you come to a place and it says that we no longer have an alcoholic mind. The obsession has been removed. The obsession, you know, just like surgery, that it's just been taken away. Be careful that you don't just stop there. You know, read a little bit further. Because then it explains it in terms that make sense to me. Because what it says is that in reality what we have is what? A daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. Anybody here spiritually fit every day of their lives? Anybody here that ever doesn't get in a blue funk? Anybody here that doesn't get to the point where you wonder about stuff? I'm not. And so what I am is mindful of the fact that that's a fragile removal. A fragile removal. And all I have to do to get it back is quit doing the things that keep it gone. Practicing the principles of this program, and that sucker will come back. Yeah, I believe that we lose a fair number of members who get hit with obsession and are not prepared to deal with it. I run into folks every once in a while, and you do too, who'll come up to me in a meeting and start telling me about themselves and say, you know, I am just so grateful to say a thing. I haven't even had a single temptation since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always figure the unspoken line that follows is, and I never will. You know, like what I like to recognize is that the problem is in the mind. And all that thing has to do, if I quit doing these things, it will revert immediately back to that old way of thinking. So that mental thing is vitally important to what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous Day. Third thing that our book describes is the physical thing. I don't understand that. I don't understand what happened to me when I was 18 years old and I lost the ability to control my drinking. I just simply know that it happened. I don't have to understand it. It's just critically important to me, life and death, in fact, that I understand it did happen, whatever it is. I don't understand the allergy phenomenon. I don't understand the phenomenon of craving. I just know that if I take a drink on the record of my life, what happens? I know it even though I haven't gone back out since I've been here. I know it on the tragic example of literally thousands of my fellows who walked that road for me. Who on earth might I think I'd be any different? That's what happened. That's what I developed. I was not a drunk. I was not just somebody. I never knew what happened to me. I just simply, every time I'd wake up in the town I wasn't supposed to be in, or in the wrong state, or in jail, or in a burning car, or sleeping in a U.S. highway, or any of the bizarre places I woke up, fired again, what I would always do is go through the same drill. Well, you've done it again, you sorry devil. And that's really what I thought it was. I thought I was basically an undisciplined fellow with very, very limited character and just was totally irresponsible. That's what I believe. Well, Yeah, I could go on all night about that. Let me just simply sort of wrap it up this way in terms of what I was like. Yeah, what I was like is an alcoholic. And I lost the ability to control that drinking, and it'll never come back. And what it meant in my life, you know, in order for me to see the impact of alcoholism in my life, all I have to do is look at that young fellow bounced out of high school, 16 years old, set out to conquer the world, going to do great things like any optimistic. Well, I had lots of fears and all that stuff, but deep down inside I thought I was a world beater in the making, and one day I would make it. That's really what I thought. And then compare that fellow to the guy 8 short years later who was living on the streets up in the city of Flint, Michigan. Now, you don't get there overnight. I mean, you don't fall out of high school straight to Skid Row in one swoop. It took me 8 years. And when I look at that, that's chaotic and quick enough. But when I look at that and say, why on earth can something like that happen? What it looks to me like when I look at my life is that it became a seemingly endless series of failures and new starts. And failures and new starts. Every time I failed and started over, settled for a little less, and a little less, and a little less. So that by the time I was 24 years old, I was living in circumstances that at one time would have been totally unimaginable for me, but they seemed remarkably normal. It's where I felt at home. I pray to my God that I never forget for one instant what that way of life, I don't mean the hunger, and I don't mean the cold, and I don't mean that. I hope and pray to my God that I never forget what that felt like as a human being. I never want to forget that constant daily visit with despair that was my entire life that David talked about so well this morning. That totally meaningless existence. There was no place in this world that I could go, that I would go, that I could call home. I never want to forget what it was like to be in my early 20s and just wish I were dead. I never want to forget that absolutely hopeless sinking feeling of being in jail over and over again to the point that it became routine. It became a normal place to be. I never want to forget the feeling of hustling and robbing folks and taking from people and hurting folks just to survive. That's what you did in that jungle. That's what I did. Never want to forget the feeling of taking handouts from strangers, of selling my blood for $5 a throat. I never want to forget that for one second. Not the physical experience of it, but what that cost in terms of humanity. I wish I could tell you that one day I had enough of that stuff and called for help and found it and been here ever since, but that just didn't happen. Like some others here, I was one who stayed there maybe one day too long. And I wound up doing the kind of thing that I know every alcoholic in this room or in any room is feared doing. Now, most of us, I think, are fairly decent people. Most of us are people who don't want to hurt folks. Now, we don't seem that way when we're in the throes, but we basically tend to be fairly decent people, fairly sensitive people. But it's just that, well, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, and I was no different. I knew that I was capable of anything. My God, anybody would. And I'd gone through the thing of hundreds of times that I hear my fellows talk about, of waking up in the morning with that panicky kind of feeling of where am I? Where am I supposed to be? What have I done? Take a look outside to see if my car was there, to see if it had blood on it. Check everything out and then breathe a sigh of relief and go do it again. And I don't know how many times I did that, but this one morning I woke up in jail in Flint. Regular customer there, knew everybody worked there, and I assumed I was in there for the same as always, either drunk or hustling or fighting or whatever. And after I was awake a while, the jailer came by, asked him when I could get out, and he said, I hope never, and walked off. I had no earthly idea what he was talking about. And then some of the other guys in the tank told me that the night before, I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city, and he'd run down and kill 2 people. And my reaction was much like yours or anybody's would be, just absolute shock and disbelief. I could not believe. I could believe it, but I couldn't handle it. And my response was just basically to push it away and pretend it wasn't true. And then they gradually accepted the truth. Only time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. But somebody found out where my family was and contacted my folks. They came up and got me released on bond. charged with manslaughter, been in there 76 days, then I hit the street. Knew that I wouldn't drink. Knew I didn't think I could physically pick up a drink. The guilt was too great. Well, just didn't understand. I got the least likely time, and I stayed sober a day and a half just by walking the streets. And, of course, I started to drink. From July to November of 56, drank like nobody I have ever seen. Literally, nobody I've ever seen. I don't mean I was the world's worst two-fisted drinker. I was one, what they call a pathological drinker. I was a guy obviously trying to drink himself to death. That was clear to me or anybody else. And then the same day of the month that Evelyn got sober, the 19th of November, of mine was 56, was when I actually had what I hope and pray was my last drink. Didn't know it was going to be. Knew it was going to be the last one for a long time, because that day I was to be tried on a manslaughter charge, and it was no trial in the sense that we're used to, certainly not like we're seeing now. None of that. I had no defense. My plea was to stand mute, and I think it said it all. Now, what do you say when you have nothing to say? They had to tell me what I'd done, and of course I was found guilty. They sentenced to a max of 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. I'd never been there. I'd never been in a penitentiary. I'd been in drunk tanks and stockades and pea farms and stuff like that. And I had an idea what Jackson was. I had hustled with some guys on the street that were in and out of that place, and I knew it wasn't Disneyland by any stretch of the imagination. And I remember that day the sentence was passed, I had an instinctive reaction of fear, I guess a very human, very natural thing, but almost simultaneous, most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was done. And the next day walked into that, literally on a log, big, looked like a big log chain between five other guys and me. And I truly did not believe I would ever come out of there alive, and honest to God, didn't care. I just didn't care. I was done. And all I wanted to do was be put away so I wouldn't have to see people and not have to try to function in this world. And I never believed I would ever see daylight again. Little did I know. I heard a thing saying, it might have been in my own head. I don't think I've ever read anywhere, but there's a thing that comes through to me that I think has great application in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you think about it in terms of your own experience. What God would use, He first reduces to nothing. Now, how little did I know that at the lowest point of my life, when every defense was gone, the perfect time for God to walk into my life. I had no earthly idea about anything like that. I didn't even believe. A little social worker walked into my life. A guy interviewed me one day. I didn't talk to people. I just sat in my cell and stared at the wall, read to keep from thinking. And one day, a little social worker called me out, interviewed me, made the same diagnosis everybody had. Said something like, God, you drink a lot. Then told me something I'd never heard before. Said, we have an AA group here at the institution. Think you better go, was the way he put it. Didn't have to. Just a flat statement. And then a little while later, got a piece of paper. It wasn't even a letter, just a little piece of paper. Ivester, 94153-3938. That was my entire identity, home address, total identity. It was in that series of numbers. He said, report to your first meeting, Groundhog. Didn't say Groundhog Day, but February 2nd of 57. And I really don't know why I didn't have to go, but I really think the only reason I went, I just didn't have any fight left. Didn't have any fight. And I walked into my first meeting, probably much like you walked in. And like Stormy said, thank God, Stormy, they didn't give me a shot like this. Isn't that a shock? Holy cow. I think I'd have died, girl. You handled it like a trooper, I tell you. Oh, my God. All I would do is just hide, you know, when I went in there. But I did. And one guy spoke to me that day. They had a correctional officer on the door. Ivester, yes, sir, sit down. And I sat down in the middle of 300 guys. And listened to the first day meeting I'd ever heard or seen. I never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never heard of it. Didn't even know people helped drunks. And I sat down and listened to that meeting. A guy named Shy Walker from Kalamazoo, Michigan, was a speaker at my first meeting, and I'll be ever grateful to that man. He later became my first sponsor. That day, I didn't identify with him whatsoever. In fact, I never did in terms of experience. He was a much different kind of man than me. But he was a truly dynamic member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was the area delegate from the state of Michigan to the General Service Conference the year that I met him. And otherwise, he was just a little, he wasn't much taller than old Alvin, that first stepdad I had. He was a little old short guy. But he was an absolute giant in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, he had about a third grade education, but he had a heart as big as the state of Michigan. What a truly loving guy. And that guy, when he spoke that day, his message to me was not what he said, and I didn't identify with anything about it. If you'd asked me when I walked out the door what happened, I'd have said, geez, I don't know. But that guy shared his story with a magical blast of enthusiasm second to none. He was one of the most absolutely enthusiastic members of this program, and I'll always be grateful for that, because I think the only thing that brought me back to my second meeting was that intangible spirit of the man, because somehow or other, it was kind of like a moth to a flame. I didn't know why I was going, but I just kept going back, and I believe it was just maybe an instinctive recognition that maybe. You know, I sat in those meetings for a long, long time. The first 8 months that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, were as miserable as any period I ever endured in my life. Because I didn't really feel like I belonged there. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I'd been drunk all my life, but I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. Thought I was too young. Thought I was too smart. Thought I was really a guy with tremendous potential, like one fella had told me one time. Really believed that. But I said I was. I hated to be the only one out of 300 that wasn't an alcoholic, so I'd say I was. But it didn't mean a thing. It didn't mean anything. It was just a word. And I kept going back over and over and over. Now, obviously, something happened. You know, what is it? Yeah, when I sat in those meetings and I think about the fact that I've never had another drink from the day I walked in there, it takes a powerful, powerful program to bring that about. Now, what is it that cuts through to a 24-year-old piece of human wreckage like that? Not only the damage of my life, but the feeling that I had of just absolute overwhelming guilt. I felt, a friend here and I were talking about this, you know, I felt utterly ashamed to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not that I was too good. I felt utterly ashamed to be in a place that was talking about healing and help and hope and love, when two fine young folks were no longer anywhere because of me. And I'll guarantee you, folks, you don't balance the scales between a street drunk and two fine young folks with their lives in front of them. Obviously, you don't. Well, what I think about that, it simply magnifies the power of the miracle to me, because I've never looked back from that day to this. And it takes something enormously powerful to pull together a life like that and then start out a brand new way to live. And I wasn't even looking for it. I kept going to meetings. I kept listening. I've always been a reader. I read everything here. And then something happened. You know, it was not mystical. It was something. You know, I think there were a number of things going on. One, the recovery group in Jackson Prison was an absolutely fine group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll always be grateful to that. It'll always be deep down my home group. Isn't it strange how much loyalty we feel to the place where we start? I feel that to the recovery, and I don't want to go to meetings there very much. I'm not a regular attender. I go back every couple of years just to talk to my chair. And in it. And make sure it ain't me, you know. So I do that. But otherwise, it'll always be special, though. And it was a fine group. I was given an excellent introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous in that group that has served me well over the years. And it was by other alcoholics who happened to be locked up there just like me. I later became one of the guys who introduced it to other guys, and it was a truly fine group. In all honesty, I'll tell you that it was probably better than 80 or 90% of the groups that I go to today. It was a fine group that practiced the fifth tradition and did one excellent job of introducing people to what this program is about. I'll always be grateful to the people who walked into that institution, because this really isn't a program of the head. Basically, it's a program of the heart. It's a language of the heart. And those alcoholics like Shy, that guy who walked into the first meeting, and the many, many, many who followed and walked in and just simply laid their lives on the line. I'll always be grateful to those folks, because they were sticking out an unquestioning hand that I could not argue with. You see, nobody needed to tell me who I was. I knew that. And I knew that I had not one single thing that any human could want, except a total wasted life. Little did I know that that's exactly what the members of Alcoholics Anonymous were fishing for. And those people who walked in and stuck out that hand to me and accepted me, not at the level that I was, but at the level of what I could become. I'll always be grateful for the people who dignified what that was about. And let me, I'll assure you that I didn't get straight because some blabbermouth just did a verbal assault on me. I got sober because some people dealt with me with love and concern and shared in an honest-to-God kind of way. People who cared and shared. I was treated like a gentleman long before I became one. I guarantee you. And that was the heart of this thing that gave me the will to live again and the knowledge that maybe I could. Now, I got turned on to Alcoholics Anonymous, to put it mildly. I became extremely active in the recovery group at Jackson. I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous then. And I'll tell you, this program worked as well for me there as it's ever worked anywhere, and maybe better. Because the toughest living I have ever endured in my life was in that place. And this program rose to the occasion, and I left that facility unmarked physically or psychologically with a brand new rebirth. I became a man in that institution in more ways than one. But in the important way, I joined the human race and became a responsible man for the first time in my life. This program worked for me. The first freedom I ever knew, I was locked up like a gorilla in a zoo. And I became free because this thing works for anybody anywhere that'll give it an honest to God shot. Well, I stayed there 3.5 years, and I got turned on to living. I finished a couple of years at Michigan State University. I was in a maximum custody joint, and I don't know if they just invented television. I never had seen much of it. I guess it was out. But they invented it, and they started piping the Michigan State University to that penitentiary. And I finished 2 years of my college while I was there. I got turned on, started to live, and then the time came, and they told me I could leave if I would go to North Carolina. And I didn't really want to go to North Carolina. I'd seen the big city. I didn't really want to do that. I didn't want to go back down there. I thought that was podunk. I told him, let me think it over for about 1/1000th of a second. I didn't tell him anything except, yes, sir, let me go. And I walked out of there absolutely committed to a new way to live. I knew when I walked out of that institution that I wasn't going back. And I knew that. And I don't mean that in any macho kind of way, like they can't put me back. I meant that I was willing to do anything it took. And I didn't care what. Whatever it took, I was willing to do to stay out. And that's been a long, long time ago. But I feel that way just as fervently today as I did then. Your bottom line, I think there has to be a fairly tough-minded reality about a new way of life. You know, it's not all just a honeymoon. I think there has to be a fundamental hard-nosed quality about this thing. That's the way I walked out of that place. Went to an AA meeting the first night I got out, and most nights thereafter for a long, long time. There were a lot of things I wanted to catch up on, but I'd learned enough to know that I had to keep my priorities straight. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found exactly what I was looking for. When I walked out of that institution, walked into my first meeting, I was home, and I knew it. Even though I didn't know a soul there, I was home with my kind of folk. And I felt that way. My God, I've been all over this continent. And I felt that way everywhere that I've ever gone. What a tremendous thing. Well, I want to share. I'm afraid to ask what time to start, but I won't keep you long. People get on my case bad if I don't tell some stuff. And the thing about it, when you sober a long, long time, you got a lot you won't tell, don't you? I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can't tell at all. But people chew me out if I don't tell some stuff, and it's important to me, of course. I have mixed feelings sometimes about telling some things that happened to me because they really are unbelievable. They're unbelievable. Most of us do have things over time that are kind of unbelievable. But I was a guy that walked out, and I was exactly what I described to you. The only job I could get was working in a cotton mill on the night shift, 10 at night to 6 in the morning. I could make meetings within a 30-mile radius and did on a regular basis. Never was late for work, and I hit the ground with that kind of feeling. Got immediately active, The group I was in sponsored an institutional group, a little prison group over near my house. And second week I was out, they asked me if I wanted to go over. And I said, God, yeah, man, you mean I can? And so they took me over. And I went and made my first talk, you know, really telling my story in that prison over there. Did it in a blackout, so I guarantee you I wasn't ready. And 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor of that group. And I'll tell you, that is not something most people just shout hallelujah about, but I'll guarantee you I did. Well, what an affirmation to be able to walk out of a place like this and then 2 months later be able to go back as a trusted servant to carry that message there. And I had some things happen, and the only thing I'll tell you is the God's truth. It's the God's truth. I had some things happen that just defy imagination. About 2 months after I was out, my parole supervisor came to me one day and he said, Tom, you're real active in this AA thing. And I said, yes, sir. And it worried me because I thought he was going to ask me to slow down because I was very active. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't. Like he didn't know, I said, you got to understand. And when I left Michigan, they put letters that big on my paper. This man's never drive a motor vehicle. This man's never drink alcoholic beverages. And I took that as an absolute fact of life. One of them was my idea and the other one was theirs. And I took them both as absolute facts. And I told him that. And he said, well, let me take a look. A couple weeks later, got a phone call, asked me to meet him at the Sears store. And it sounds like Mayberry, you know, but that's where the license agent was. And when I walked up to Sears, I stood at the front door and I could see all the way to the back where the counter was where they gave out licenses. And my pro guy was standing there with the fellow that turned out to be the license guy. I walked up, he introduced me, the man handed me a driver's license. He didn't even ask me if I could drive. He didn't take a test, didn't drive nothing, didn't even pay for it. I don't know if anybody did. I'm sure that ain't legal. But I've been driving 35 years on it, so it's a... I tell you what I really believe that is. I've had some people say, man, you must have had some real political connections. Yeah, I did. The sheriff of that county used to lock me up a lot. That was my political... I'll tell you what I really believe it is. I believe that when God's got work for you to do, the walls come down. And I know that on the experience of my own as well as the experience of God knows how many hundreds of people that I've seen go back into seemingly impossible things. Walls come down. Stayed very active, got into service, was elected DCM 5 months after I was out. Most people don't say whoopee about that. I guarantee you I did. Because when I had left that institution, it's not melodrama, it's just a fact. When I left that institution, I honest to God wondered if anybody would ever trust me to do anything. If anybody would ever really feel confident about me, would feel the closeness and be willing to entrust responsibility to me, truly wondered. And here I was asked by the most important people in this world to me, the members of AA in 12 cities, asked to be their trusted servant. And I'll guarantee you that meant something to me. 2 years after I was out, sitting in my house one day and phone rang. There's a guy from the state capitol and he asked for Mr. Ivester. I got on the phone and he introduced himself. He was a man who had visited the AA group I sponsored one time. And he said, Mr. Ivester, we are opening up the rehabilitation program. Barely had been invented, I think, in North Carolina. And he said, we're opening up the rehabilitation program in the prison system. And we were wondering if you would consider taking a position. And I swear to God, I've never been offered a job in my life. Unless it's some drunk didn't have one himself. And this guy's talking about a position as a supervisor in a system. And man, I'll tell you, it had never crossed my mind. Or anybody else's back then. I mean, that was unheard of. And I said, well, gee whiz, man, I'd rather do that than anything I know. And I meant that. But you know how it is. Down where I live, I said, shoot. They ain't never done that in history. They ain't going to start with me. But they did. And I was employed in 1961 as in the old rehab thing and did that for several years. And then one day, I mean, you never are prepared for the things that happen. And one day I was going along having a great time, man. I didn't take a vacation for 9 years. From what? Yeah. And one day the head of our prison system asked me to come into his office, and I wondered, you know, what I'd done wrong. And he said, Tom, I'd like for you to take an assignment for me. And I said, yes, sir. What? I thought he wanted me to speak to a Rotary Club. It was really what I thought he had in mind. And I said, yes, sir, what? And he said, I would like for you to take over an institution as warden. And I said, holy cow. I mean, you know, that's startling. Even though I was in the system, can you imagine how totally unthinkable something like that is? Of all the wild dreams I had when I was locked up, I'll guarantee you that one never made the list. So, one of these days I'm going to get out here and run one of these suckers, you know. And he answered that, and I said, oh, gee whiz. I honest to God, wasn't sure. I said, can you let me think about it? And he said, I'll give you 5 minutes. I got to make a decision. And I said, okay, I took 5 minutes. When I prayed like a dog, went back in, said, okay, I'll do it. And it made sense to me that maybe I would be able to do something. I didn't really want to do it, but I thought maybe it'll help me do some things that I think ought to be done if I've got some power to do it. And so that's what I did for the next 20 years was, basically headed up institutions and developed several institutions in my state. Had a truly, truly rewarding profession. Now I didn't just fall out of a maximum custody cell and become head of an institution. I think you know better than that. You know, I did bother to finish my degree in correctional administration, and I did bother to outwork everybody I've ever met. You know, I did bother to do something like that. I'm not one of those who believes you get discovered on the drugstore counter. You know, that I know better than that. So, I developed my career track like any other professional, and it's been a truly rewarding career. I'm grateful that I'm still in it, and I've been eligible to retire for about 6 years now. But for what? Yeah, that's a great thing, and that's obviously tremendously meaningful to me. It's really not where it's all at, though. It's really not where it's all at. Now, this program is not about what you do for a living. That's personally important to me, and I hope symbolically important to you. You know, one reason people get on me about not telling that kind of thing is that it's so important to see the hope. And I remember how important it was to me to listen to people who had truly had remarkable experiences in terms of their lives starting to work. And so in the interest of hope is the reason I share that, and because it's part of the experience. You truly never know. Once you give your life to this simple program, you truly never know where it's going to take you. And so that's part of it. The thing that really matters is that, you know, I'm still I'm a simple guy in a lot of ways. I lead a complicated life, but I'm basically a simple fellow. I live in a small little old town, and I'm a strong and active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a current member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't used to be. I am. I'm still very active. In fact, I'm the current GSR for my group. I'm probably the oldest one in North America, I would think. But I'm one who believes that sometimes you have to lead by example and not by just exhortation, you know. And so I don't ever want to get to think I get to be too old, that I'm above those things. So I'm the GSR. I'm still very active in AA at every level you can possibly imagine. And it's not because I'm a dedicated idiot with a mission. It's because this way of life is so tremendously rewarding to me. Now, Mildred and I were talking about the fact that, you know, truly we do have some great things happen. And you believe this. Every significant thing that's happened to me in my recovery, I had absolutely nothing to do with. Not one single thing. Now, I did bother to work hard, and I did bother to get training. But the significant stuff that's happened in my life absolutely was no credit to me. It was something that happened as the result of this simple program. And so Yeah, when I was in the penitentiary, like I said, I never did dream of becoming a warden or anything like that. I'll tell you what I dreamed about. I guess what a lot of guys in a joint dream about. I dreamed about being free. I don't mean just out. I mean free for the first time in my life. I dreamed about living in a community and being a citizen. Never had. And most folks who've been citizens all their lives, that probably has no real meaning to them. But if you have ever wandered the face of this earth alone with no place to really call home, you may know what it meant. A citizen. And a pretty doggone good citizen, too. I don't mess up my community. I serve my community. I'm active in the civic life. I pay my taxes regularly. I vote. I vote every time. I vote sometimes, don't even know who's running. But I remember when I couldn't vote. So I vote conscientiously and usually wrong, but I vote. Married, I didn't know if I would ever get into that, but my wife and I just completed 27 years of continuous marriage. Married a little girl from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. And I married that little girl because I love her with all my heart. And when I asked her to marry me, it was with the full realization for the first time in my life that I was doing that because I loved her, because I wanted to take care of her, because I wanted to be her husband. What a beautiful, beautiful feeling. 27 years later, I still feel the same way. And therefore, 27 years later, we still have an excellent marriage. And I'm deeply grateful for that. This program is vital to it. Even though I'd been sober 11 years when we were married, she's a very active member of Al-Anon, a very active member of Al-Anon, and it's because of how much it enriches our lives. And I believe that a program that's built on, a marriage that's built on these principles is going to have a pretty good chance of succeeding. It's not guaranteed, but I believe it gives it a good chance. We've got a couple of kids that I'm extremely proud of. They are something else. I got a daughter that graduated from University of North Carolina about a year ago. Did my best to talk her out of it, but I'll be darned she didn't take a degree in psychology. And she's learning why I advised her not to do that right now, trying to find out what do you do with it. So she's preparing now to go back to graduate school so she can get a job, is what it comes down to. And I have a son that, God willing, will graduate from medical school next year. And it's truly something that, when I look at those youngsters and see, those are things that I dreamed about. Not a life of rich and splendor, but a life that had substance and meaning. Truly wondered if things like that would ever be in the cards for me. Dreamed that someday I might have a life that was useful and whole. And I'm here to tell you that those dreams come true in every possible way. Every possible way. And let me close up with this. I won't go over the whole deal, but a thing I discovered just a while back that just sort of framed some thoughts for me had to do with what is it that gives fulfillment in life. And they dealt with some of the obvious things about having your life in pretty good shape. And then the one that I want to just sort of talk about for a minute in closing, in talking about fulfillment. Now, what is it that brings about fulfillment? What is it that gives you that sense of wholeness and satisfaction that I've done what I'm here to do? And when I think about that, I realize how truly fortunate we are. Now, think with me just a minute. Think with me just a minute. And maybe you can identify the same way that I do. Think back to the line is what does the fulfillment is to leave a legacy. To leave a legacy. Think back to the last time that you were so doggone proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that you just wanted to shout it. Think back to the last time that when you thought about being in AA and you thought about what you were doing, you felt 10 feet tall. Think back to the last time that your cup was just absolutely running over. Think about the time when you were so grateful to have the opportunity to do what you were doing that you just felt left-handed. Think about that. And then think about the circumstances that surrounded it. And I'll bet you just about anything you want to bet that it had absolutely nothing to do with personal attainment. That it had nothing to do with personal achievement. That it had nothing to do with real success in the material sense. When I think back to what is it that gives me fulfillment, I look back over 38 years in this program, and every time I identify a place when I felt that way, it's because I was doing what this program's about, and that's learning how to give in a special kind of way. Learning how to open up and share and let my life be used and then enter into life with other people. You know, there really is an important kind of connection, like I was talking about with Dottie. There's an important kind of connection between level of action and level of spirit. And those things that produce the deep sense of satisfaction and fulfillment have to do when I open up and learn that the giving here is the key to what the joy is about. The day I walked in here, Stormy, the day I walked in here, I started the most exciting adventure that any human could imagine. And all I did was give this broken and wasted life over to this program, and God's carried me places I wouldn't have even dared dream of going. The beauty is, and if you don't feel that way, if you're not on fire with this program, if you're not enthused about what's going on, if you're not intensely proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, for God's sakes, open up, reach out. Don't let this thing go by. Man, there's only one time here. Don't miss it. Thanks, folks.